There's somebody made a quote, there's nothing moves the imagination like a lighthouse. And certainly, I can remember from my days at sea on the bridge, not that I was a navigating officer, but being on the bridge at night and how one watched, first of all for the loom of the light, and then actually raising the light itself. And of course the lighthouse comes into its own then from the seaward side, not necessarily from the landward side, they're oftentimes in remote places, a cluster of buildings, but from the sea they're so terribly important. I suppose there are ones that have, I don't know whether romantic is the word, but have a character of their own, ones like the Fastnet and the Tusker, Skellig, and Bull Rock there are, and Black Rock in Mayo. These ones, I suppose, because one associates them with fearsome storms and so on, that they do have a particular character, more so than perhaps the ones on the coast. So, yes, I suppose the Fastnet and the Tusker, Bull Rock, Skellig, Eagle Island, Black Rock, Inishtraul, the most northerly light of all on the island. And then funny places like Rattlin Island, there's three lighthouses. I think the offshore lights, the rock lighthouses as they call them, have a fascination all their own.
On this rock is a lonely place, attending the lighthouse light. Day after day I see no face, only the moons by night. At times the roaring sea is hushed and mirrors the starry heavens above. Or wavelets dance, auroral flushed, bejeweling each wrack-strewn cove. Aslant the dome steel fog jibs sway out on this rock.
You see, my father, he was a lighthouse keeper. I was his eldest son. And it was a natural way of life. I couldn't see myself in anything else. So when I reached the age of 18, I just automatically, even though he gave me a chance of a good education, I was still just, I wanted to get back into the service myself. So I joined up in 1925 as a lighthouse man, a supernumerary out here at the Bailey Lighthouse. And I went on from there right through 42 years in the service. Well, of course, I was a supernumerary keeper for the best part of 12 months. And during that 12 months, I served on the Bull Rock for 8 months. That's down off Dursey Head. And I was there for 8 months. And then I moved up then on appointment as an assistant keeper to Ironmore Island, County Donegal. And I was there for the best part of 2 years. Still a single man, bachelor, yeah. And from there, I was transferred down. I was rather lucky, you know, in this way that I didn't spend a lot of my time in the very isolated stations. I was transferred from Armagh Island down to Spitbank in Cork Harbour, which at that time was considered a very good station, although I didn't, looking back on my life now, I wouldn't think it was, for a single man to go down to live in Cove on a very small pay. I hadn't very much money leaving it, I can assure you. So I was there for the best part of 5 years, and then I was transferred up to the Ireland Islands in Galway. I was there for 3 years. The lighthouse I was on in the Ardennes was on the Brannock Rock, which is about 2 miles off the main Inishmore, which is the main island of Ardenne. And we often got long overdue reliefs there, you know, at that time, because we were relieved by one of the Curraghs, you know. They used to relieve us, and, well, you can quite appreciate that in a winter time. You wouldn't very often make the passage there. So I was there for 3 years, and then, while I was stationed there, then I met my wife, and I got married. She was a Cork lady. She was working in Galway, and we met, and we got married. And then I was transferred down to Galleyhead, which is near Roscarbery in West Cork. And I was 2 years there. And, of course, my wife was living with me there on the station. It was a headland station. And I moved from there then to New Island, which is one of the Copeland Islands just at the entrance to Belfast Lough. And I was there then until the war broke out. And at the end of 1940, the winter of 40-41, I was transferred down to Ballycotton in East Cork. And I was there all during the war. And then I was promoted in charge of stations, and my first assignment was at a station called Poorhead, which is between Ballycotton and Roches Point on the East Cork coast. And it's not a lighthouse, it was not a lighthouse in the sense that there was no lighthouse there, but it was a fog signal station. They had a very powerful siren there.
I'm going to start up the Lister engine now to get the fog signal test. That's where the sound emanates. And that hurls out to sea now. And what you sometimes find is that in the thick fog, you don't find much of a kind of echo. It echoes and re-echoes out to sea. You usually find when she's clearing or fairly clear, there's more of an echo, you know. But if you listen hard enough, she'll echo. No, she'll echo, re-echo, re-echo, echo out to sea. But actually, she's not regarded as a particularly good navigational aid, you know. You could be in a boat out to sea there, you know, and you mightn't be too sure which direction you're coming from. I mean, the sound could hit the side of a cliff somewhere, and you'll be unsure if you're out to sea where your position is. But I suppose if all else fails, it's as good as anything, you know.
The diaphone fog signal system fails. We have a standby system here, which operates on a siren principle. And I believe that the sound is a pure musical note in G major. Whether that's true or not, no, I couldn't tell you, you know. It's a 1 5-second blast every 60 seconds. And we are on watch, and the fog signal is blasting. This is timed regularly, so that you're aware of any irregularity of the actual characteristic of the fog signal. A lighthouse is a navigational aid, and to mark it as a navigational aid, each piece of navigational aid has a certain characteristic. Now, the actual characteristic of this fog signal here is 1 5-second blast every 60 seconds. Say the Bull Rock, there'll be 2 blasts every 60 seconds, you know. It's kind of a marker, really. So say you're out to sea in a little boat or something, you know, when you hear 2 blasts and you hear interval 60 seconds, you know it's the Bailey.
I wasn't left very long there, about a year and a half, and then I was moved down to the Skelligs. I was there for 4 years, and of course my wife lived ashore in Valentia. At that time, in the lighthouse service, you see, on those isolated rocks, they had shore stations where the families lived. And my wife lived in Valentia, and we had two sons, and they went to the national school in Valentia. Well, of course, the famous Skelligs Rock, it was like being on board a ship. You had two other shipmates with you, and well, you carried out a certain routine. You had to keep watches during the night, maintain the light, maintain the fog signal if there was one on, keep an eye out for fog. And we used to have our meals at the set time each day, and then there were a lot of chores to be done, such as maintaining the stations. They were all kept in pretty good order, you know, and that kind of thing. So that was the general routine. Of course, we used to look forward to the relief boat every fortnight, or at that time, of course, the reliefs, especially on the Skelligs, they might run a week, fortnight overdue. And we'd be glad to see it and get some fresh food. Of course, when the relief went overdue, we had to live on our own homemade bread and tinned stuff and all this kind of thing, you know. In the north of Ireland, when the war broke out, we were brought under the Admiralty, the British Admiralty, and they controlled. And for the first time that I really experienced radio sets. They supplied a radio set for the New Ireland Lighthouse, and we had to listen in there on this radio continuously.
This is the radio telephone. Here's where we contact other lighthouses down the coast. We do routine calls 8:05, 11:05, and 4:05. And if we've any messages to send or messages to come back, we pass them along. That is a message being passed from Kish Lighthouse to Tusker Rock. It'll be passed on to one of our tenders, the Irish Light Ship, Granuaile, around the coast.
See, when I joined the service, there was no such a thing as radio. There was no communication at the shore. Once you were out on a rock like the Skelligs, you were completely cut off. But then, my service developed, and as the years went on, radio came into the service. Well, that to me was tremendous, you see, because you heard all the news and the world news, and you hadn't to wait for a fortnight to get the newspapers to hear all that was going on. That was the radio. But then the greatest thing of all that I experienced was my first experience of the radio telephone. And that was on the Skelligs about 1940-47. And it was really marvellous to be able to lift this telephone and talk ashore and say over to you, and the keeper ashore would call you back and tell you all the news, tell you how all the families were and all this kind of thing. But now, of course, they have it developed to such an extent that they have the ordinary telephone on all these lighthouses. And they have some kind of a system where you just dial a number and it's picked up on some business ashore. I don't know what it is, and they transmit it on or relay it on into the local exchange, and you make your call to any place you want to. So that was it must be really marvellous, you know. Yeah, so they're not a bit isolated, no. Actually, I have the number of the Fastnet lighthouse in my pocket there. A fellow gave it to me one time, if I ever cared to ring him up to have a chat. It's unbelievable, isn't it? Yeah.
Kish Lighthouse. Billy Lighthouse. Are you there, over? Kish, Bailey Lighthouse, good afternoon to you, Frank. I have one RT message. Are you ready to take down? Over.
Bailey, Kish, Roger, Frank, go ahead, please, over.
Kish, Bailey. Okay, it's addressed to PK, Kish, 08/1545. And the text, reference your 08/1200 signal, code B for Bravo. It's end of message and assigned PK Bailey. I repeat. It's the PK Kish 08/1545. Reference your 08/1200 signal. Code B for Bravo, PK Bailey. Over.
Bailey, Leader Kish. Okay, friend, check this. PK Kish 08/1545. And it takes reference your 08/1200 signal. Code B. End of S and signature PK Bailey. Right, friend, over.
Kish Lighthouse Bailey, yes, Frank, you have it all correct. We've nothing further for you. Over.
Okay, friend. So we'll hear you. Cheers now, Kish out.
Kish Lighthouse Bailey out.
Out on this rock in its mantle drab, thick mist comes stealing round the tower. Ship's sirens moan, and gulls' cries stab the air, as in the lee they cower. Skies break. The sun's about to win through cloud, and beam on every side. Leg basking shark show dorsal fin, swim lazily against the west going tide, and fed the otter comes to play out on this rock.
In the museum, we have three types of lighthouse light vessels, dating back to 1740. One of the first light vessels was the Kish, which was stationed at the mouth of the Liffey. Now, these light vessels are navigational marks and aids to navigation. They're anchored in positions where we couldn't build a lighthouse, and therefore they help out, like with the navigation. They also carry a top mark on telling you which side to pass the vessel on. Now, these vessels, being moored, they couldn't move out of the way, and when any other vessel came up, they were a dead duck. They could be hit by anything, like, especially in fog. In fact, the Kish has been hit three times. The day mark on the light vessels are on the mast, generally two or one round ball. The light on the light vessels, the early ones had to be hoisted up at night. The later ones were already up there. No, they were a fixed light, and after a time, they used to revolve aroundwards. They also have a fog signal, which is distinctive. Every one of them has their own fog signal, which is sent out and, like, with fog guns, a bell, or something like that. And in early times, they even used a drum. The accommodation, each ship has an accommodation for roughly 10 to 12 men, including a skipper and a mate. There's one instance there of the Dawn. She actually broke away in 1936 in a blizzard, and she drifted around for 3 days. The men had to jump off her and were taken ashore by the local lifeboat. They won quite a lot of medals at this. This old lens from the Bailey Lighthouse was presented to the Maritime Museum in 1979. As you can hear it yourself, slowly moving around, she gives a light. In here, in the museum, every 23 seconds, she gives a flash.
On the side of the lantern, you can actually see the ancient lighthouse, which was built in 1671. And this was the original Bailey Lighthouse. And what they used to do is, at daytime, they used to burn turf as a daymark. At nighttime, they had a brazier where they must have burned coal or wood. I don't know the actual material that they burnt. In 1814, the Bailey was transferred to here, the position we're standing in now. I believe that at one time this was a fort built by Cromwell. And in fact, if you see the houses above there, the AK's dwellings, and what is now the helipad house, they used to be the barracks for Cromwell's troops. And Bailey, I think, is an ancient name for the fort. And so that the name of the lighthouse is derived from its source. You're now at the very bottom of the tower, which at the Bailey here is an assembly point in case of nuclear fallout. As you see here, there's three tanks full of water for use as we assemble here in the case of a nuclear fallout. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll descend the tower. As you see, the steps of granite, which it's quite characteristic of lighthouses, you know? Not only in the Irish coast, but the English coast, I think, as well. You notice a funnel going right through the centre of the tower from top to the bottom. Well, it's now obsolete, and the original use was certainly obsolete down in the Bay Lighthouse, and the original use was that there was a weight attached to a wire in the funnel, and as the pull of the weight descended down the funnel, effectively it revolved the lens around, usually on the back of mercury or ball bearings. But nowadays there's an electric motor which revolves the lens around automatically. One time you had to actually wind the wire across a drum, and as the weight went up the funnel, she was set then to go down again. You had to give her another wind. This is done frequently during the man's watch, during the night hours. And here you have the standby siren fog signal, which we operated earlier. And she's housed here in this little alcove here on the second flight. This is the diaphone house, which is just a little room which houses the trumpets and the pistons and all the paraphernalia to do with the diaphone. And it's the old style type fog signal. And going back before this system, they used to have rockets which used to fire at night time. And some of the old lads are telling me they used to actually fire a night flash.
It was an explosive fog signal. And it was about 600 feet above sea level. Now, the lighthouse itself was 250 feet, and you had to climb up what I think we call the North Road, right up to this, as we call it, the firing hut. And you had to spend 4 hours there firing explosive signals every, I think it was every 6 minutes now, I'm not quite sure. And you had to stay there then until, you see, there was another man on watch down on the light. Well, he'd flash a light, or he'd put a light on a window and show you if it was clear underneath, because the skelligs used to get capped in with cloud, you see, with fog. And it'd be quite clear underneath, and you'd be up there, and you'd be still in a dense fog, you see. So he'd put up a light, and when you would see that, you'd notice all clear below, and you'd shut down and come down. But that was a tough job, one of the toughest I experienced. You can imagine climbing up that terrible road under the cliff there at night. And if there were no electric lights around, we just had a hand lantern and climbed up, and you were always afraid that some of the loose rocks would come hurtling down on top of you or something like that as you climbed up, you know. It was really, I'd say looking back, it was one of the toughest jobs that I experienced in the lighthouse service.
Now we come to the top part section of the tower, which is called the lantern. And at the Bay Lighthouse, there is four sections of the lens. And I'll show you here. I'll take the curtains down. The lens is made of glass, and effectively they're prisms placed in a certain position. So that what happens is that every scrap of light is utilized so that you get a pure beam of light coming out of the center here, which we call the bullseye, and therefore getting your beam. And this revolves at the Bay Lighthouse at one flash every 20 seconds. So from this bullseye here to this section here is a period of 20 seconds when the lens is rotating. You can actually open the lens out and I'll show you the source of the light, which is an electric bulb. And the bulb has to be dead center in the lens, and this is the actual source of the light, and the lens revolves around this source. It's in a certain characteristic. But you actually see here two bulbs instead of one. Well, the reason for that is that if the main light source bulb blew, the other bulb would automatically trip into position. And if this fails automatically, you can do so manually by just flicking the switch at the bottom there, you know. But I say it has to be dead center in the lens, because if it's not, what you do, you get what's called a false flash, whereby you don't get all the light utilized so that it goes through the bullseye and the pure beam. You get sort of little tiny little lights sort of going off here and going off there, you know. So that's the reason why it has to be dead center in the lens. The actual lens revolves around electrically, and at one time the actual source of the light was incandescent. At some stations, they still have the incandescent light as a kind of a standby.
The system in my time, of course, was incandescent, which is, a vaporized paraffin oil. You see, the paraffin was, it's just the same as you've often seen a primer stove, where the air pressure, the compressed air, it forces the paraffin up through a heated retort. And it forms a vapor, and you put a mantle on it. I think that's the way I could describe it to you. And that was the system of lighting when I was there. But of course, that's all gone years ago. They're all electrified now.
On this rock at sunset's glow, a white spindrift on the lantern pane sparkles and glistens and runs below in rivulets of fire and into the sea again. A ghostly form comes floating down, alights upon the flagpole's stay, great saucer eyes and speckled gown. An owl, bewildered by the ray, and the lantern clock talks time away. out on this rock.
Watches were divided up into 6 to 10, 10 to 2, 2 to 6. And now, if you were on the 6 to 10 in the morning, you had to look after the light, of course, up till sunrise. And then at sunrise, you extinguish the light. You pull down the curtains on the lantern. As I say, it was an incandescent in my time. You oiled up. You did all the necessary. You prepared the light in the morning for the night, the man on the 6 to 10 watch. You oiled up the light, you cleaned the retort, you left the lantern ready for the lighting watch in the evening. And then after that, then you cleaned up the mess room and got the kettle going and all for the other two fellows that were coming on duty at 10 o'clock. So you called them at 10 and they came down and we generally had our breakfast together. And, I don't know what system they have now, you see. But when I was on the rocks, generally the man on the 10 to 2, he'd look after the mess room then. And we'd all prepare the dinner, you see. And then he'd look after it and get it cooked. And we'd move out, and if there were any jobs to be done around the station, and maintenance jobs, cleaning jobs, anything like that, well, we'd carry out those duties. And then we'd get back and have our dinner together. Well, then, in the winter time, generally, the man in the 2 to 6, well, he'd clean up, and he'd have to keep an eye out, of course, for fog and that. And we'd... Well, sometimes the lads might turn in to the bunk for an hour because they'd be coming on duty again at night, you see. 6 to 10 men might turn lie down for an hour or two of the fellow coming on at 10 at night, you know. But in the summertime, we generally, especially on the skellies, we'd go out and have a walk around or maybe do a bit of fishing or something like that, you know. I used to read a lot and I was very fond of writing. I was quite a prolific correspondent. I used to write to a lot of my relations and friends and that. But some of the lads were interested in carpentry and mat making and, you know, hobbies like that. But I never had any great flair for these things. Well, of course, if the weather was fine and calm, you were able to step out on the skelligs. But if there were any rough seas or there was swell in the water, well, we had to use what they call a gaff landing, which is I could only describe it to you as a derrick and a rope fall on it, and this swung out over the water, clear of the rough shore. And lower down, and you just put your foot in what we used to call a bowl and hold onto the rope, and the lads on the rock would heave you up onto the platform. And then when you were landed, then the fellow going ashore was similar. He was lowered back into the boat. That was in any kind of rough weather, you know. And that was the general system all around, where on those isolated rocks.
out on this rock sweet moments come, when memory glides on swiftless wings to my childhood cot, a bent thatched home, to an ivied church where a choir sings. Then I kneel and pray that when I grow old, when the heavenly keeper my soul shall call, he will knight me with a sword of gold and end my lonesomeness midst loved ones all. The lighthouse light in the light's fulgent ray, far from this rock.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.